This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
So what do you want to be when you grow up? It's probably the most asked question in a young person's life. For many, answering it is a chore well into adulthood. But when they get to college, they're asked to instantly start down whatever path it is they think they want to take.
I live in a college town, and it strikes me as kind of crazy that even the kids in this town, in some sense, don't know what their parents do.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll hear why the arts and sciences should still be a big part of higher education. We'll also learn about a huge community farm and learning center located in the middle of a northern New York City. And we'll spend an academic minute finding time to play. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. When entering college, students are asked to do one of two things: pick a major or go undeclared. For many, it's not that cut and dried a choice. There are some who have known just what they want to do with their life for as long as they remember, while others graduate without a clue as to what the future holds for them. And many don't find their calling until much later. For the next 2 weeks, we'll be talking about this situation. Today, the best of our knowledge is Patrick Garrett talks to Dan Rockmore about his new book, What Are the Arts and Sciences? A Guide for the Curious. Well, Patrick started out with the obvious question: what are the arts and sciences?
As I imagine them, or as the book tries to indicate, they're basically the disciplines that have evolved in the academy as we've labeled them over time. And now if you enter a college, university, and you could be in a division of arts and sciences, and there would be a bunch of choices about subjects of study, and those are them. And so I suppose in some sense they're kind of the crystallization, the pure inquiry of various subjects of interest.
Well, in your book, you compile a bunch of different areas and categories from engineering to one you even wrote yourself, mathematics. What makes each of these subject areas important?
Well, the genesis of the book, honestly, was sort of twofold. On the one hand, I live in a kind of college town, and it just strikes me as kind of crazy that even the kids in this town, in some sense, don't know what their parents do, many of them being professors of X. And that felt like a missed opportunity. If anybody should know what kinds of questions people are studying, it should be these children, many of whom are curious about the world. And moreover, just from my many conversations with my friends and, the children of my friends, if they're coming to visit Dartmouth, they don't actually know what the subjects of inquiry are. High school doesn't generally prepare us for that. And colleges have a nice way of bucketing them into the disciplines. So that was how I chose them. I didn't sit back and think about what were the big questions of inquiry. I feel like that would be a different book, but rather what kinds of things have we evolved to that people study some systematic way, and just sort of taking as a fact that these things are there, that they're interesting and important. I mean, I certainly believe that they're interesting and important, but again, recognizing that not everybody even knows what kinds of questions people are thinking about.
When I was in high school, and then I went to college myself, a lot of what I learned in college in a lot of these courses almost seemed repeated from high school. Like you had, I majored in mass communications and music industry, obviously a very specialized degree and a very broad degree. When you have multiple different fields, why is it important that, say, somebody in music industry learns math?
I guess there are two ways to answer that. I mean, I feel like often when people ask that question, they have a very operational a very operational context. It's like, well, I need to do something, and what are the tools that I explicitly need to do them tomorrow? And, you know, you could probably list them, and you could construct a curriculum that only exposes you to that, and then you would be done. And you'd be done for tomorrow. And the question of whether or not that would help you generally later in life is I think a different question. When someone majors in a subject, if a college or university has been thoughtful about constructing that major or constructing their curriculum, I do think in some sense they have to think about today and tomorrow. What's a 30,000-foot view of the thing you're interested in? Because that thing is going to move in time, and in fact your interests will move in time, and how could we best ensure that you'll be a little bit more adaptable to the way that thing will change. So it's a little bit of a balance, I think. I mean, you want stuff, again, which feels relevant today. But the truth is that this is kind of the moment, the 4 years, where we're also trying to prepare you for the things that you don't even know you're going to need, or the things that you don't even know are going to occur. You have to prepare somebody to have a flexible mind and not just a focused mind.
Now, when people often talk about a liberal education versus, say, a more, you know, analytic, STEM-based one, in your book, you cover everything from more liberally oriented, you know, courses to the sciences. Why are they important to each other?
The fact is that the liberal arts grew out of thousands of years ago, a division that was made in what people studied, which were kind of, as we call them, the arts and sciences. And the sciences were whatever: arithmetic, geometry, astronomy, and music, in fact. And the arts were kind of the arts of argument, so logic, rhetoric, and grammar. So when you talk about the liberal arts, I think today, I mean, what you're really talking about is a broad-based education where you do require students to focus in something, but you also require them to sample from the things that they aren't focused on. And, you know, so the question of why a broad background is important, I think you can answer from a bunch of different perspectives. I think just to be an informed citizen, for example, you should be able to have intelligent conversations on a variety of topics and moreover, to be able to have a critical mind with respect to lots of different topics. You know, if what you're really asking is, you know, why do the humanities matter more than engineering, or do they matter? I mean, quite honestly, the most complicated problems that we face in society, at the end of the day, they're not going to find technological solutions. They're going to find solutions or compromises through a deeper understanding of culture, history, and language. You know, you're not, there is no technical solution that will make everyone safe from terrorism, for example. You would hope that through negotiation and better understanding of different cultures that's informed by all kinds of humanistic inquiries, that you could get to a place where seemingly or cultures that start at different places now find a way to talk to each other. So honestly, there's a sense in which I believe that the humanities matter much more for society than the sciences, but the sciences kind of are easier to turn into money, to be perfectly blunt.
Now, I find that often in public radio, listeners would call themselves constant learners, or they're always curious. The title of your book is What Are the Arts and Sciences? A Guide for the Curious. Why did you pick that title?
Because I wanted to make it clear in the title that this wasn't an academic book, or it isn't an academic book. I was pretty careful, both in thinking about how I wanted the book to be designed, even from the fact of having no footnotes, although there are notes at the end, but that you could just dip into it as a curious person, that this wasn't an academic treatise about the origin of the arts and sciences and that whole thing, but rather that I think there are a lot of people who are curious and would be delighted to read in, you know, 10 to 15 pages, a tiny entree, if you like, into the various disciplines. And curious people are of all ages. You know, kids are curious, college students remain curious, and, you know, and adults of all ages remain curious. So the title was quite purposeful as to signal that this wasn't going to be, or that it isn't an academic book, but rather just for someone who's interested in ideas.
Dan Rockmore is a professor of computer science and mathematics at Dartmouth College and the author of What Are the Arts and Sciences? A Guide for the Curious. Professor Rockmore, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks. That was fun.
Again, the name of Dan Rockmore's new book is What Are the Arts and Sciences? A Guide for the Curious. He spoke to the best of our knowledge's Patrick Garrett. Next week, we'll talk to another author who says you can do anything you want with a liberal arts education. Still to come, a growing city in northern New York still has room for a working farm. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Saratoga Springs, for those of you who don't know, is a city of about 26,000 people in northern New York at the foothills of the Adirondack Mountains. It's best known for its world-famous thoroughbred racetrack and a history of being a summer playground for the rich and famous. It's also growing, both population-wise and geographically. This year, Pitney Meadows Community Farm, the last remaining working farm within the city limits, has a new management team that will use the property as a center for agriculture and education. They've established a community garden on the property, featuring farm and food training and education. They'll be a year-round farm hub that shares the bounty of upstate New York agriculture and community. The grounds will also provide nature trails and host community events. The Best of Our Knowledge's Joe Donahue recently spoke to part of that team. Barbara Glazier has been a leader in open space preservation in Saratoga Springs since the 1980s and played a key role in the establishment of Pitney Meadows Community Farm. Natalie Walsh is the director of the new Pitney Meadows Community Gardens.
So let us start with you, Barbara, and how this all came to be, because we are talking about a very large piece of property.
You are, Joe. It's 166 acres right in what used to be the edge of the city, and now it's closer to the whole heart of the city as the city has grown and expanded. The Pitney Farm, it goes back, it's been in the Pitney family since the 1860s, and this farm has remained farmland, serving different kinds of agricultural purposes over all these many years. 20 years ago, the Saratoga Springs Open Space Plan was adopted by the City of Saratoga Springs and highlighted this farm as a really important resource to protect over time. And so here we are 20 years later, and it came a time when the Pitney family wanted to sell this farm, but they really wanted to keep it in agriculture. And we had this wonderful convergence of the city's open space plan wanting to protect the farm, the family ready to preserve the farm. We had done a bond act in 2005 that allowed the city to bond up to $5 million for open space protection, and we were able to secure $1 million of that for the purchase. The Pitneys sold it at a discount, and a not-for-profit was established, the Pitney Meadows Community Farm, to acquire it. So this great convergence of community interest, the Pitneys being ready to have the land preserved and being willing to do it at a discounted price, and a not-for-profit ready and willing to receive it, made this possible. So in December, we acquired the land and now are setting about to create the future of that land.
I will get in a moment and certainly bring Natalie into the conversation to talk about what's going into the land as far as what your ultimate vision is. To me, though, Barbara, the key word in all of this is community. That's really what it's all about, isn't it?
Absolutely. Yes. You know, we have a lot of lands in Saratoga County, but they're often at the edges or far away. This farm is right so close to the heart of the community. It's across the street from the YMCA, next to the Saratoga Spa State Park, across from the high school, close to Skidmore College, on a bus line, and will itself be part of a greenbelt bicycle trail system. So it's a farm that invites the community to easily access it for all kinds of events and programming.
So, Natalie, now you are a lifelong gardener, so to be able to kind of oversee a project like this has to be a bit of a wonderful gift.
It is a wonderful gift. I've worked on other community gardens. This is definitely the largest one that we'll be doing. And one of the wonderful things about this garden is how accessible it is to everyone. As Barbara was saying, it's on the bike path, bus routes, so it'll be readily accessible and very close to downtown. We're sowing a field of sunflowers. Within the field, there'll be a playhouse created where the walls are sunflowers. That'll be a place where children can go to play. We have programs intended for adults and children to paint and draw. There'll be some classes, the different sunflowers and other aspects of the garden. And then we're hoping to do an art show at the end of the season.
You have showed me on your iPad a beautiful rendering of what this will look like when it's all said and done, the plan.
Yes.
The first thing the first thing I said to you when I saw it was that it's enormous. It's a lot. It's very big.
It is. But not all of it is happening the first year. There's an access up the center part will be the part that we do this year.
Yeah.
So when it's all completed, we could have up to 200 beds. This year, the goal is 55.
Now, when you look at that, and Barbara, I'm interested in your thought of what is the importance, the selling point for gardeners and people to come in and for the community as a whole of why we should have a community garden and how we benefit as a community of having that space.
I think as Saratoga Springs has grown, and more people are coming and living in apartments and condominiums, this provides a place for people to go and have their backyard, so to speak. They can have a plot there in order to raise vegetables or flowers, and in so doing, join with a community of other people who are tending, learning, working with each other. So it's getting outdoors. It's being able to grow food. It's being able to grow food in the company of others with the support of gardeners like Natalie. We have a number of master gardeners and other instructors who will be part of the garden programming. So it's an experiment in community, it's an experiment in agricultural production, and it gives the opportunity for us to do a lot of education with children as well. You know, I grew up with grandparents who had those victory gardens after World War II.
Sure.
And I didn't grow up with that. I grew up in Minnesota, and I used to go down to Grandpa's farm in Iowa, and I ended up not having that skill set. And I think now we have more people who are interested in locally grown, organic, or growing the food that they want for their table. I think it gives us a real opportunity to do that.
With that said, there is really a combination here of for purpose as well as for, yes, the product of the garden, but also just beauty.
Absolutely. There's the beauty. There's the harvesting. It's the healthy lifestyle. There's the ability to garden as a stress reliever. There's a giant social aspect to gardens in general. People love to come in and just smell the flowers, whether or not they're a gardener. So, yes, there are many different aspects that draw people.
So let's say I'm interested in a plot. Bring me through that process of what you go through.
Okay, so there's an application online at pitneymeadows.org/communitygardens. You can download it there, and on the application it indicates the there's a sliding scale for the cost of each bed. And to tell you quickly, the 4x8s are from $35 to $100, and we did that so that people could participate. So it's what people can afford. And then there are in-ground plots that are 8 by 12, much larger, and those run from 100 to 300, again, sliding scale. And then we also included taller plots that are 24 inches tall. They're actually grown in a livestock watering trough. They are 3 by 8 feet, and those are also the same as the 4 by 8s. They're $35 to $100.
Okay, so I've gone through the process, and I'm going to have a plot.
Okay.
Then do I decide what goes into it, or do I work with you as to what goes into it? And then once I am maintaining it, do you oversee it? How does that
yes.
work?
Okay. Pretty much you can grow what you like, but I did say that no invasive plants. There'll be a place for some of the invasives that are under control. For example, peppermint. Everyone wants peppermint and spearmint. We'll have separate areas for those so that we can contain them. But mostly people will put in what they want to eat, what they enjoy planting. And then they have the help of not only myself as a master gardener, but there are about 5 other master gardeners on board who will also be there and willing to help them with anything that comes up. I'll be the garden director so that if any issues come up, whether it's diseases or bugs or anything at all, I'll be there.
Name that bug.
Name that bug.
That's right.
Name that bug.
Yeah.
And Barbara, so you have obviously shown here, this is going to be growing over several years.
It will be growing over several years, and we will grow it as we can build it. As we can raise the funds to underwrite the various beds, we will continue to grow and extend it. That's the plan.
So if I'm growing whatever, it's a vegetable garden. Now, do the fruits of that labor, do they come to me or do they go to the community? How does that work?
Once you rent the bed, that's yours. That's like your little backyard there.
Okay.
And whatever you grow is your property, yours to take home. We are growing several beds deliberately in order to give to the needy. And we have some Girl Scouts who are interested in overseeing that as part of their badge awards.
We'll also have some of the beds which are dedicated for kids. One will be a sandbox. There'll be a place to grow unusual flowers and plants that kids would be interested in. So whether it's the children of the gardeners or other children who want to come and just be able to experience the garden, there'll be a special place for them as part of this whole garden.
Barbara Glazier and Natalie Walsh are part of the new management team running Pitney Meadows Community Farm and Community Garden in Saratoga Springs, New York. They spoke to the best of our knowledge's Joe Donahue. You can learn more at PitneyMeadowsCommunityFarm.org. The school day has become a lot more challenging, even for kindergartners. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Kindergarten is now more structured with less time for play. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Christopher P. Brown, professor in the Department of Curriculum at the University of Texas at Austin, examines whether this is a good thing for kids.
Kindergarten has changed significantly in the last few years. Kindergarten used to be a place where children had the freedom to pursue their own learning interests. They engaged in play-based activities like blocks and dramatic play. Now, it's a place where often 20 or more children interact with one teacher for an entire school day. They engage in as many as 15 different academic activities, such as decoding word drills, practicing sight words, counting up to 100 by ones, fives, and tens, and writing in journals. For 5- and 6-year-olds, as well as their teachers, this is a lot of work. Why do these changes matter? Researchers consistently show that classrooms that offer children the opportunities for play-based and child-centered learning help them grow academically, socially, and emotionally. Recess especially helps children restore their attention for learning in the classroom. Focusing on rules can diminish children's curiosity and their willingness to take academic risks, and it impedes their self-confidence and motivation as learners. All of this can negatively impact their performance in school and in later life. So how might kindergarten be improved? No one that I've studied, including the kindergartners themselves, is advocating for the elimination of academics in kindergarten. Kindergartners need to learn academic skills so that they can succeed in school. However, researchers, parents, teachers, and policymakers are concerned with how the implementation of standards and tests have eliminated activities that offer children choice and voice in their learning. Kindergartners require more balanced learning experiences that nurture their development and their desire to learn and interact with others. This will improve their performance in school and assist them in seeing school as a place that will help them and their friends be better people.
That was Christopher P. Brown of the University of Texas at Austin. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org, and you can find us on Twitter at TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.